Blog Talk Radio.
I hear the song worth singing. I can tell. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
Welcome to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Bay. And today's date is February the 26th, 2020. Ladies and gentlemen, you know if you join us on a regular basis, you know the slogan for this show, if it's power in numbers and the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation and design companies to address the effects of higher energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the unemployment and underemployment of young African men and women around this country, locally and nationally. Also to educate the Black community, locally and nationally, about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through Black Talk Radio vernacular, such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. It's also brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BS HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative. And you can get more information on that initiative by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. That's Positive Change, P as in Paul, C as in cat.com. Stroll over to our GoFundMe link. Please click on that link and you'll find a detailed project rationale as to why we've put together this platform. And we're broadcasting over the World Wide Web, over Blog Talk Radio. We're streaming over Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter as we speak. And we're very, very happy to have a very, very dynamic guest for our first portion of our show this morning, and she's in our green room, and we want to bring her right in. But I want to first talk about this young lady, Mrs. Kia L. Jackson. She's a very, very dynamic young lady who happens to be an alumnus of my alma mater, Morgan State University, Go Bears. So we got to put a plug in there for what the work's been put in, and we're out here in life doing what we do every day. So without further ado, hello, good morning, Mrs. Jackson.
Good morning, Mr. Bethay, and thank you so much for having me again. It's always a pleasure to come on with you and your audience.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you, Akia, here to talk about the Black Experience. Now, this is an organization that you found to educate the Black community about the cannabis industry on a global basis. And I had the privilege of meeting you at a brain trust that was put on by your organization at the Congressional Black Caucus a couple of years back. And you have been as we say, you've been a trooper with this thing. You don't talk it, you walk it. And that's what I like about you. And you've been doing some things here in the DMV market area. And I guess as I gained knowledge from communicating with you, that y'all had a forum yesterday on Capitol here in Washington, D.C., on the nation's capital. Could you sort of share a little bit about that and sort of share a little bit about this upcoming educational workshop you have coming up on this coming Saturday, the 29th? Unfortunately, I've got to be at Morgan because for the basketball game or another engagement, I would be able to make it, but I've already got a previous engagement, but would you please sort of give us a little of your background and sort of go into what's going on with your organization, what y'all are doing, some of the outstanding things y'all are doing to educate the Black community around this cannabis industry?
Yes, sir. So the Black Experience in Cannabis is an organization that is solely focused on providing a platform for Black Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, people of color to participate in the cannabis sector and providing a table where we can come together and discuss things that are focused around economic empowerment and inclusion and policy, as well as highlighting entrepreneurs in this industry and connecting them with key investors. Also sharing our narratives so that we can impact the decision makers and provide opportunities for people to actually go back and regurgitate what they've learned and make impact in their own community. Our call to action is that we want you to be a change agent around changing minds and destigmatizing so that we can have global acceptance for proper medication, and we can reach the goal of federal legalization and descheduling of cannabis as a Schedule I narcotic. We need research, we need medicine, and we're going to continue to have these conversations and reach out to people until it's done. We will continue to be, we've been at the Congressional Black Caucus since 2017. We had the pleasure of meeting and working with Mr. Bethea in 2018. We did it in 2019. And this year for 2020, we're actually expanding it to 2 days, which will be September 17th and September 18th in Washington, D.C., 2020. And it's going to be a big push because this is a voting year. And look forward to receive information about that and how you can participate. The most recent thing that we did yesterday is we held a hearing session on Capitol Hill in the Rayburn House office building, and the topic was inclusion in cannabis policy. We had a dynamic panel from all Black panel on Capitol Hill, all Black panel of people from the industry. We had representation from the Minority Cannabis Business Association. We had Brandon Wyatt. We had Todd Hughes from Minority Cannabis Business Association. We had from North Star Liberty. We had Tyler McFadden and Kamani Jefferson. We also had Joan Perot Fonseca from Herbal Alternatives Medical Dispensary in Washington, D.C., as well as the room was filled with staffers. It was standing room only. Photography, we were hosted by Financial Services Innovation Coalition, which is directed by Kevin Kimball. And as a result, the turnout was phenomenal. And everybody left with a surge of energy. The staffers were, had amazing questions and were excited to go back to their congressional offices and implement what they learned from our session. So we're going to continue this. We're looking to schedule another one within the next month or two. But it was just very important that we made that impact during Black History Month and during this busy, popular season on Capitol Hill right now. As Mr. Bethea was saying.
Now, Kia, you have something coming up on this Saturday here for our listeners here in the DMV market area here. And we want people not to meet us there. We don't want them to meet us there. So why don't you tell people what's coming up on this coming Saturday, and we're going to sort of flip gears about this industry, because it's great to hear that the staffers for the members of the CBC came and packed that room, because this is a new industry, a dawning industry, and it ties right back into, people want to know, well, your show is called Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. Well, the fact of the matter is, when you begin to talk about anything, I don't care what it is, everything starts with energy and everything ends with energy. And this industry in fiscal year 2000, the last the numbers I was able to get, in 2000, I think it was 18, the cannabis industry spent almost 11 point something million dollars for energy to grow cannabis, because a lot of cannabis has to be grown in controlled environments because of the geographic locations of where those farms may be. And a lot of them are actually being grown in indoor grow facilities. And these facilities are very, very cost intensive in terms of operating when it comes to their energy costs. So when we begin to look at that, then what's the solution? Well, the solution is the same thing as the sun. But rather than just growing it outside, they're using solar energy technology to do that, and they're using solar and hydrogenetics in this industry. And we've got to look at how we as Black folk can get paid on all ends, because we have a ton of African-American solar development opportunities as it relates to Black farmers, Black families with private land in the Deep South who want to get into this energy game, but they must identify what they call off-takers, and that would be a person who needs to buy that energy from that solar farm. And this cannabis industry, it doesn't make any difference if you're in a deregulated market where you can identify a grower in California. You might have a large-scale 30 or 40 megawatt solar farm in North Carolina. You can still sell that energy to California because you uplink it and it goes right out to your customers through the grid. So it doesn't make any difference where the solar farm is located. You can still provide that energy to grow that crop to that customer who needs to buy that energy at a cheaper cost than he will be able to get it from, what, the local utility company. And people are getting rich, Black folks, doing this in deregulated markets. Our issue is that the majority of our folks with land are in the deeper South in states that are regulated. That means one company controls the generation of energy, transmission of energy to the customer, and you cannot go out if you are a solar power plant developer and you have the land and negotiate the terms of contract and the price that you can sell that energy per kilowatt hour in a regulated market. So this is creating billions not millions, but billions of dollars in opportunity for African Americans to get into this industry, because we're talking about the energy industry. We're talking about an industry. you're talking a $1 trillion industry when you're talking energy, okay?
Mm-hmm,
this gives opportunity the cannabis and hemp industries, the growth of this green economy. You got two green economies growing over there, and all of it's generating green. And we've got some structural issues as it relates to all of this, because when we began to look at the cannabis industry, you've elegantly said, Kia, because cannabis is classified as a narcotic, you know, the banking industry, people who are in that business, and we're talking about industry with the growth potential. When you begin to look at your private investment online magazines and what they project as the growth industry, you're going to find it's going to be 5G, it's going to be renewable energy, and it's going to be the cannabis and hemp industry, because that's what's happening, folks. Now, when we begin to look at these industries and we begin to cross-sector, how do we get vertically integrated into this industry when we begin to talk about people who have land? Not only can they build the solar farm, but they can build the grow facility or grow that cannabis for those folks,
people
who
with licenses.
With the licenses that are in the retail business, because they have to have growers. And I'm saying that we as African-American folk need to be looking at how we can get this thing vertically integrated. I have a gentleman by the name of Mr. Efren Jernigan, and there is a YouTube video which can be located by people logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com, and you will go over to our news and events, and you'll be able to scroll down, and you'll see Sunnyside Lane. Now, this gentleman, Kia, is building a 70-megawatt solar power plant on a brown landfill in Houston, Texas. They have already won the award. They have already been endorsed by the mayor's office and administration, and they're building a physical building, a large educational center that will be there that will deal with cannabis and hemp research. They will be powering everything. The whole operation will be powered through solar, but they're looking for off-takers for that energy. And the off-takers becomes who? The growers of the cannabis. So there's more than one way for our people to get vertically integrated in this energy. We can get involved in it from the building of this and development of the solar energy plants for the energy. We can get involved as a grower and to supply those retail license operators. And this is what we need to be talking about, is vertical integration into this cannabis and hemp industries, because
we need to be looking because there's a lot of other opportunities. You know, people, when you're speaking in terms of vertical, I think people want to understand that every state has a different rollout and laws around how their cannabis and hemp programs are working. But in terms of Maryland, Maryland has a vertical alignment, and what that means is that you, when you get a license in the state of Maryland, you don't just get a license to have a dispensary. You have a license that covers from cultivation, processing, retail, even including your security and your transportation. And not all states have vertical. However, I want to, you know, want black people to understand, you know, that owning a license, whether it's a vertical license or if you're in Washington, D.C., you have to, they don't have vertical. You have to get the cultivator's licenses are different from the applications for a dispensary license. And as a result of that, those two different types of processes, you want, as you know, we don't want to just only have a seat at the table for owning a dispensary or obtaining or being awarded a license, but that's just one part of it. We can be involved in, and I think in so many ways. And I think what you're saying, or I'm just pulling from what you're saying, is that if we are a part of energy, if we are able to offer the services to someone who has a license, you know, that is an ancillary business. That is another leg spinoff of how we can be involved in this industry, having our stake and actually, you know, have benefiting in terms of capital resources without just people, you know, the romanticism of owning a dispensary. And this is actually a more environmentally impactive way of participating by doing that. Also, how do we get to that point is we need people to actually also participate in at policy and being a part of, you know, the bills, being a part of the legislation, working with congressional members, attending your hearings, and so that you can push these agendas forward so that we can do it.
Well, you just see it. A mainstay with me, Kia, I'm constantly running to either the Derrickson building or one of the buildings. I'm constantly on the hill going to summits that are being held by energy advocacy organizations. And, you know, the folks don't look like us. You know what I'm saying? 99.9% of the time, I'm the only only person who looks like us in the room. And it is very disheartening when I am speaking on behalf of a whole race of folks and institutions that nobody elected me to be that spokesperson. But because I know what those key issues are, for example, the transportation bill that will probably be the only thing that will get passed this year. In this political quagmire we find ourselves in, trying to get 45 out the door and trying to get somebody else ahead of the show. But it is what it is. And what happens is the transportation bill has $1 billion for electric vehicle charging infrastructure.
Wow.
Now, what does that mean to the African-American community? Well, if you're a veteran, there's a $50,000 no-interest loan. You have Tesla. You got ChargePoint. You have a number of companies. You go right to the website. You get your certification by taking one of the electrical nutrition courses. They're basically offered at a lot of your junior colleges. You'll find it the online North American Board of Electric Practitioners. It takes about 6 months And then you have some on practical experience that you can get. But once you get your certifications from one of these programs, you can pretty much write your own ticket in terms of being able to subcontract the work every day. Now, I'll give you an example. When people make everything sound so sophisticated and so difficult, but it's not that hard. If you know what the plug is that your stove or your washer and dryer plugs in, well, that's the same plug that they're installing in residential homes for that electric EV car. And that is what this is all being brought on by what? Climate change, push, it's called the green economy, and everything is moving forward. So we know to get the carbon out of the air, but guess what's one of the best plants, two plants on the earth, Kia, to take carbon out of the atmosphere? Would you tell our listening audience? It's hemp. Is hemp and cannabis.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It purifies
hemp and cannabis.
The carbon out, it takes the carbon out of the air. Now, here we have, I know in South Carolina, one African American who got a license as to grow hemp for in the whole state.
Wow.
I had the head of the Industrial Hemp Trade Association out of Asheville, North Carolina, the gentleman on this show, talking about the tie-in between the state legislature, North Carolina A&T, and North Carolina State were the first two institutions that were grandfathered into that bill. But he indicated after the farm bill was passed last year, it legalized industrial hemp being grown in all 50 states in the United States, including Puerto Rico and Alaska. So industrial hemp, the United States manufacturing was importing over $600 million from China. I'm trying to think of the other countries that they were in. The exports annually. Now this can be all bought from American farmers.
Right.
But when we began to look at the cannabis, when we began to look at the hemp industry, you will find very few opportunities are licensing being issued to people of African-American descent. Then you have the issue with the banking where you can't put this money in the bank. Would you please, Kia, sort of explain to our people some of the structural, financial structural issues that our banks need to be involved in, especially the African American owned bankers association. I think the black African American bankers should be front and center, the National Association of Black Bankers, pushing to try to get the legislation changed so those properly licensed people who have dispensaries can put that money in the bank account. You can't get a bank account. Am I wrong or right? Am I saying something is wrong? Or could you please educate the public?
Right now, they have passed the Safe Banking Act of 2019. If you get a chance, just Google Safe Banking Act of 2019. And the Safe Banking Act was a proposed legislation regarding the disposition of funds gained through the cannabis industry in the United States. And basically what that means is that if you own any cannabis business, which is a full cash-based business, And with that, and because banks are federal, covered by federal FDIC insurance, you cannot, and cannabis is federally illegal. It's a state business. Therefore, you cannot put your money in the bank. So there
That's
is
insane.
A divide, but there's a divide between. It's insane. It's a divide between federal and state. And so here you have these companies that are operating. They're making, some of these dispensaries are making between $30,000 a day to $150,000 a week in cash. In cash. So you have a major security issue. And that's why it's called safety, because, I mean, look at the target that you are operating on a monthly basis with over $700,000 in cash that you have to move around. You have to store this money. Not only are you dealing with safety around the money, you have to have safety around the actual product. You have you're cultivating pounds and pounds and pounds of cannabis that has to then be transported to a processing center where you can do different things with the flower by turning this into concentrates that are used to consume it in different ways. And then you have to transfer all of that, the flower and the concentrates, to the actual retail dispensary. And then from the dispensary is where all the retail sales transaction is occurring. And that money there has to be stored somewhere. So you have money funneling all around those places because they have to pay the cultivation centers in cash. They have to pay the processing centers in cash. And the dispensary owners are buying this stuff with cash. And then you have patients who are coming into these dispensaries and they can only pay with cash. Well, they will take, some dispensaries will take card payments, debit card payments, however, and have those processed through smaller financial transaction companies like a Square or a PayPal or something of the sort. But to actually put your money in a bank where it is safely insured is not happening. And so we fought. People have been lobbying and lobbying and have fought for the Safe Banking Act. It was passed. It also applied to the 280E tax bill, where that issue was that if you were in the cannabis business, you were not allowed tax credits and advantages that all other businesses get because, again, you're dealing with federal government. And that issue is finally being addressed through Congress. You know, it's the process of things going through the House and all of the committees that have to touch on it, and then it gets passed through Senate and the committees that have to pass through that. And that's the issue now that we have with anything is getting it passed through the Senate because of who we have, you know, in office right now.
Can you say Mitch McConnell? Can you say the Grim Reaper? Grim Reaper?
By the time we get it to get a vote, it's a process.
You know, see, this is why I wanted to have you on here, because our people need to know why they need to go to vote. See,
yes.
When you got people who are pushing back, you make a law and you criminalize our communities for almost 30 years. When we start the decriminalization of the same product that you was locking people up and throwing Junior Boy and the crew, throwing the key away, kids, people they wasn't looking at no time. They was throwing away the time because they had mandatory minimums. Okay, this played havoc in our communities. Now that the cannabis industry is being decriminalized, now. Yesterday, I had the privilege of listening to Rick Freeway Ross. I'm talking about not the rapper. I'm talking about the Rick Ross, as we remember from the cocaine epidemic that hit
crack.
This country back in crack cocaine epidemic, but crack and cocaine is the same thing. And all they doing is putting it on the stove using a little baking soda. So if don't ask me how I know how they do what they do, but I know how they do what they do, okay? Now, I'll leave it at that. Now, what I'm saying is this. When I began to look at me being in getting a PhD in human psychology, not only did I graduate from a Morgan State College, but I drove a taxi cab in the streets of Washington, D.C. for 44 years at night. And the people who I hauled looked like me, okay? So I have been able to deal folks on a real close and up personal everyday piece of called life. And you learn a lot about how things work. And I'm saying all that to say when we begin to look at the impacts that just the cannabis number of people who have went to jail and had records for cannabis, the numbers are staggering. Now, here we are today in states decriminalizing this. And every state, as you eloquently indicated, Kia, does something different, how they roll their programs out and what they do. But we don't get the opportunity to take advantage of these opportunities. And as I indicated, we had yesterday, Brother Carl Nelson had a Rick Ross. And he was talking about him getting involved in the legal cannabis industry and going around the country and trying to educate our community about these opportunities because he's based out of California. As we know, California seems to always lead the nation. But we just got a caller, Kia, to join us. Hello, caller.
Hello, caller. Hey, how you doing? This is Daniel. How are you?
Hi, Daniel. How you doing? Hey, welcome to.
I'm doing well, and I wanted to comment on something that I heard you talking about, and that was definitely the war on drugs. And I used to say all the time that the war on drugs to me became like kind of the new Jim Crow or the new whatever segregation policies are could have been enacted. It became like the new thing, you know, it became that new next thing.
And it was a war on people of color, man. That's what it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't a war on no drugs. It was a war on brown, black and brown folk, all folks around this country, and poor white folks who didn't have no cash.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when it's all said and done, a lawyer told me one time, I was in the courthouse, he said, well, let me try to tell you something. Capital punishment has always been defined. Those without capital get punished, okay? Now,
well, you know what? I want to interrupt you, gentlemen, just to take it back to the basics. And we can start
right.
with our Constitution. The 13th Amendment in the United States Constitution abolished slavery and involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime. So
right.
when we look at the basic part of our Constitution, except as a punishment for crime, which is why we have the largest penal system in the world, because it is modern-day slavery. How do we perpetuate modern-day slavery? Through the war on drugs was a brand that was created to continue to imprison people of color. How do we keep them locked up?
Yeah.
well, we can't do it this way, but we can now change it over. And that's a very important part is language. When these bills, these ideas are turned into bills, people have to participate in amending the language. How is it written? It sounds good, but it's not written, and people aren't understanding the colloquialism. People aren't understanding the verbiage, and they're not at the table when these things are happening. Even for the mayor of Washington, D.C., who wrote out a state act for cannabis and Washington, D.C., the entire language needs to be changed. It sounds good. But there's so many, if you really read between the lines, there are some things that need to be absolutely changed. It still does not allow for people who have been most directly harmed by this campaign of war on drugs to have equal participation in this cannabis industry as a business. And so when you talk about the war on drugs, we have to, like, I just start with the 13th Amendment. It's there for a reason.
Well, I agree with you. Honestly, I think your analysis was great, and I agree with you. And I'm saying, in the modern sensibility of just talking to modern people who might not be as educated, I'm complimenting you as you, and is that I think sometimes you just need something to relate to people to make them understand that. The criminal class that happens, because I'm from Baltimore City, you know, and I just see, you know, so much, just, you know, I actually recently just moved out of Baltimore. And don't get me wrong, I love Baltimore. I'm from there. I love it. But I recently moved out, and I see so much tragedy. And you look at it, and to me, it's all a matter of bad policy. Like, they always want to blame the people. Like, they want to blame the people. They want to say, oh, well, the people are no good. But I'm like, no, it's not that. It's bad law. Bad law creates these situations.
We agree. We agree with that. And one of the things that we have to be real about is look, being that we're trying to stay on point and talk about the cannabis and the hemp industry, and specifically more the cannabis industry. But Kia, when you begin to look at the history of the plant, and you look at how the image of racism played into the criminalization of the cannabis a plant in the first place, because cannabis and hemp both were used in this country for industrial purposes. One was to build rope for the Navy and ships. But and we look at how
about this? The first American flag. The first American flag was made of hemp.
Exactly.
And we look at the history of this country, and we look at how people who had opportunities taken away from them under the cloak of this is something, it's an evil plant, because it's going to be used to get white women and black men, they get to smoke in that thing, and then they go off and do the other thing. And this is how
propaganda that pushed Reefer Madness, the Reefer Madness frenzy. It was created, and it came out of the actual era from jazz, ragtime, and jazz music culture, when there was a huge influx of young white people who were attracted to the music and that culture, and because the musicians consumed it, they were like, you know, and
it's cool,
and also let's look at the ending of prohibition around alcohol. There was a whole whole task force that was created specifically for that. After alcohol became legal, they needed a job. So they were able to to transfer those people right on over to focus on criminalizing around cannabis and using that as the new vessel to push, you know, from the 1937 to Nixon and to Ronald Reagan, and I'm going to say it, and even Bill Clinton.
Oh,
no question.
Bill Clinton. No question.
Was actually so guilty, he apologized later. Bill Clinton said, now, don't get me wrong, I don't excuse him for this. Now, that's you. Everybody has their own level of forgiveness.
Yeah. Because people are still in prison right now. And that's why his apology doesn't matter unless you free people who are locked up right now for cannabis. If you're locked up right now serving cannabis, nonviolent cannabis charges, you need to be free.
Yeah, and he said I was sorry to be part of the prison industrial complex.
Excuse me. Let's keep this conversation a conversation.
No,
we can all talk to and have a conversation, but we can't all talk at the same time. Now,
I know it won't be like the debate last night.
Nobody hear anything, and then I listen to the audience. You know that calling number is 646-668-2948. Anyone else that wants to join us, you're welcome here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. That's 646-668-2948. Please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the calling number. Now, you're making a very, very interesting point, both of you, here in our caller. Now, one of the things that I look at, me hailing from a farm belt, I'm like Nick. I grew up right near Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I come from a small town called Dillon, South Carolina. So I grew up in the fields, what we would call harvesting tobacco. Now, everybody knew what weed was, and they were growing it back in the day, okay?
Yeah.
It's always been intriguing to me to see how billions of dollars have been lost to our farmers, and nobody's suffering more in this country than the U.S. small farmer, because people have been denied the opportunity to cultivate industrial hemp and legal cannabis in this country because of the propaganda that was used to criminalize a plant that had so many commercial and municipal benefits for the for the population, and it's an economy create. We're talking about something that creates an economy that is we can't even put a number on the potential opportunities and wealth opportunities it will give those people to become young millionaires in this industry just simply by being able to buy stock in the right companies. We don't even have the conversation in the African-American community here about the auxiliary spinoff companies like the CBD oil companies, the companies that do the extract manufacturing, the opportunities, as we were talking as we began the show, talking about the thousands and thousands of Black farmers in the Deep South in regulated states who want to build solar farms and cultivate industrial hemp and cannabis, and they're locked out because of legislation in those markets and laws that need to be changed to be able to give those people opportunities to get in the game. So if we could sort of go back and sort of hit on some of those areas, and I want to thank you, caller, for calling in and being with us today, okay? All right.
Yeah.
You have a great day.
And right before
Go ahead, Akia.
Yes. No, I was just listening to what you were saying. I think if you want to get back to, we were talking about how blacks can participate in providing energy resources for cultivators and cultivation centers who are, you know, growing indoors. And so when we're speaking about cultivation centers, we're talking about indoor growth and providing those energy renewable sources for them. And we were talking about how blacks can participate in congressional activities to ensure that the language is clear for black people to have a stake in that.
Well, I know you're a very, very busy person, Ms. Jackson, so I can keep you until the top of the hour. We got about 12 more minutes if you can stay with us. And I want to sort of go back and make our listening audience aware of the fact that you got this event coming up on Saturday, and we don't want people to meet us there. We want people to meet us there, and I want you to give the location, time, and sort of give the names of the speakers and a little of the background of their backgrounds of what they're doing in the industry. If we can do that.
Yes, we're starting a monthly series, a talk series called Contact. And Contact is for education and networking for newcomers to the cannabis industry and for disadvantaged entrepreneurs who are trying to participate in this cannabis industry geared towards people of color primarily. And we are going to be doing it every month. We're going to put together one or two industry experts and leaders so that we can have an intimate setting. The room isn't even, we hold about 30 people, but we can do it two times in one day. This is just the first one. This is our pilot, and the discussion is titled From Seed to Sale. And we have Hope Wiseman, who is the third black woman in the United States. She's in Maryland, in Capitol Heights, Maryland. She's the co-owner of Mary and Maine Medical Cannabis Dispensary.
I've had the privilege of meeting
Ms. Wiseman.
I met her at the CBC event last year, and sort of shared some information. So I know that she's doing some things, but we've got a lot of young people out here in this business, young African-American people in this business, and people don't know that they are in the business. So
when we say young, she's in the 30 and under group. So, yes. We also are going to have our other speaker on Saturday is going to be Jay Sutton. He is the owner of a brand called the Green Tie Club. He is also a legacy grower here in Washington, D.C., and he is going to speak from the cultivator side. What that means is that in Washington, D.C., we have the opportunity where people can grow. So you have a dispensary option, and you also have a person such as, you know, anybody that lives in their own private residence. A person can grow up to 6 plants per person. If there's 2 people in the home, you can have 12 plants. And so we're going to have 2 spectrums, from a person who cultivates under that, and then a person who is under the retail, which is the sales side of retail on a legal scale. And we're going to have about 30 people. There's seats left. The tickets are $25. We want to make it affordable so people don't feel like it's too expensive that they can't participate. We also want to keep it an intimate group so that you get to have one-on-one. You get to ask questions and get good answers from people and not be hurried along. So this event, if you would like to attend and fill up the last seat that we have, we are on Eventbrite. And the title, if you go on Eventbrite and you type in contact, and you could type in my name, Kia Jackson. You can you will find, you can type in Washington, D.C., Saturday, the 29th of February, contact under the search bar for Eventbrite, and you will see the ticket link there.
Yeah, well, Kia, you know, I don't like my folks out there to be surprised. So you got something that to me is not a lot that you're asking for people to come, because people need to learn. Our people got to understand one thing. Knowledge ain't, information is not free. And sometimes you got to invest in yourself if you want to do something.
Yeah.
So I know you have a slight cover there. So would you let people know what that is now, so they won't be getting there talking about?
$25.
Put it right out, sister. Put it out there so they know. Then it won't be no issue, because you know, like you said, you got a few seats left. But I like for people to know what it is. Then they won't be saying, "Oh man, he should have had put that information out." Yeah, well, the information's out there, so I don't have to hear. We don't have to hear that one. So
we're going to do it every month. So stay in touch with us, so you can. If you don't make this one, you can make the next one. We're going to be doing it every month.
And I'm going to have you on here more on a periodic basis, because, like I said, if I'd known you were doing what you're doing yesterday, I would have been on the hill, because I had the time to come, because I like to go to events that have a lot of young people involved in it. And I bring up this issue about the energy side of this business and how they can get involved in that aspect, because you can put a solar energy into any of the online platforms, whether it be Indeed, ZipRecruiter, Jobs to Careers, you name it, and put your zip code in, and you will see a tremendous amount of career opportunities in the renewable energy industry right here in the DMV market area. They got all, I can say, thousands of positions available, but if you don't have the certifications, you can't get these positions. Now, a lot of these positions, some of them are degree positions, and a lot of our people have those qualifications already, but if they don't know about those opportunities, hey, it is what it is. That's what the young folks like to say. It is what it is. So with that being said, I know I only have about five more minutes here, Ms. Jackson. So if there's anything you want to share with our listening audience before leaving here, because I've already had you here an hour already, man. Time flies.
It does. It was so fun, and I'm so excited that you reached out to have me on here again. I look forward to being invited back. I hope that your listeners and your audience enjoy, receiving some of the information that we gave out here today. There's so much more, and I want to thank you for providing a platform of information and education for people, because that's, it's not, it is what it is. This is what this, you're doing the work. That's the connection. People need access to information. If they had information, when you know better, you do better, people will participate. So please keep doing this work. It's needed. And the listeners, I encourage you to share with other people to sign on and to listen to Positive Change. And give them the website, positivechangepc.com.
Well, like I said, it's just like I tell you, when I met you at the convention center, we Morganites, so we in it for the long haul. It's not a short sprint. It's long. We distance runners. So we've been on this. You've been on this path. I've been on my path, but the paths cross each other. So like I said, I've been able to make some excellent contacts from the Brain Trust that you did an outstanding job producing a couple of years back at the Congressional Black Caucus CBC weekend, and the gentleman from New Frontier Data.
John Kahia.
Yeah, he's been on here a couple of times, and I mean, this young brother is brilliant, and he really, really knows the industry, and they cover it all. They do. You want research and data about the cannabis and industrial hemp industry worldwide, the new frontier data, folks. They got the information, folks. And if you want to get into to a business, you need the information and you need the research, and you can go and sign up online, and it didn't cost anything, and you can get this information. You can do your homework, because that's what it takes. I don't care what it is that you're doing. You don't get no more out of something than you put into it. And that's on the real side. So, sister, it's always a pleasure with a double measure to have
you,
Ms.
Jackson.
Thank you
so much. Thank you and your audience. I look forward to more. And you all make the rest of the week great.
Okay, and you have a blessed day, sister. And you have
a
great
day.
And thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that was Ms. Kia Jackson with the Black Experience. Very dynamic, very, very sharp sister. And, you know, it's always a pleasure to have her to come on, to take time from her busy schedule, so to join me here on this platform, Solar Now and the Future, with its economic impact on Black America. Because when I began to look at the industrial hemp and the cannabis industry, we were looking for off-takers to purchase renewable solar energy from power plants for potential clients that we have been trying to work with to see if it's economically feasible and doing the preliminary assessment to even try to develop a couple of pieces in solar farm initiatives that I've been involved in and working with. And as I've indicated here before, we've been able to get a deal on the table, but it's in a regulated market, ladies and gentlemen. And until we can do the same thing that I've said time and time again, identify off-takers that would be able to pay us enough for the return on investment, when it's just a deal on a piece of paper, to make it plain. So we're realistic in terms of what we have to do in this industry. And what we're saying is, if folks got land and access to capital, why are they being shut out other than regulation? That is what it comes down to. Now, we're going to take a pause for the calls, and we'll be back here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And we're going to sort of shift gears here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
I hear the song worth singing. I do too. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing. I got you. Sing it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And you know, If you join us on a regular basis, you know that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Now, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we keep it moving on this show. Now, we're talking about the farm, and here we're talking about Farmer's Guide to Going Solar. This is being put out by the Department of Energy, Department of Solar Technology Office, and it was published on February 25th, 2020, of course. A growing number of farms and agricultural businesses are looking for solar to power their daily operations. Thanks to part of the Solar Energy Technologies Office investments, the cost of going solar has declined, enabling more installation across the country. Consider these questions to help you determine what best is for you and your farm. What are the benefits of co-locating solar and a crop production? Will solar molecules contaminate the soil underneath and around them? Can solar molecules change the microclimate underneath the molecules and worsen invasion, species, fungi, and other pest problems? Will solar molecules heat up and dry out vegetation or crops under the molecules? Can wild animals like antelope and elk graze under solar molecules? Can domestic animals like sheep, cattle graze around mounted solar facilities? What is the impact of solar molecules on birds and other wildlife species? Can you grow native habitable vegetables underneath solar molecules? Will solar molecules drive up the price of food? Is it safe to spray chemicals near solar molecules? Can solar molecules power irrigation, impact irrigation equipment? It gives you a whole list of questions that a person who's in the farming business needs to know. So I thought this was some very, very good information for me to put out there to Mr. Larry Shirley Jr. down in Jackson, Mississippi. You said y'all want this show to be targeted for your listening audience. This is the information, okay? So when we're doing our research and we're putting this show together, we're looking at how we can sort of come up with some things that can help the African-American community locally and nationally here on this platform, Solar Now in the Future, with its economic impact on Black America. So this is what we do here on Solar Now and the Future. Now, as we have looked at that issue, there are a number of other issues that have been brought to the forefront in this whole arena. Now, I had opened up a whole segment, but I'll use this material at another date, and it deals with our former subject, where is marijuana legal in the U.S. in 2020? So that was something that had opened up there, and we wanted to sort of look at some other things that are going on around the country. And one of the things is what's happening right now in the state of North Carolina with the issue of regulation and deregulation being a real hot topic locally and nationally, as these renewable portfolio standard laws are being passed in all 50 states. Now, North Carolina, in this particular article, Duke Energy's monopoly in North Carolina, it's complicated. This article was written by Elizabeth Outs, and it was published on February 25th, 2020, in the Energy News Network. And this was a very, very, I found to be interesting article about what's going on. As neighboring states inch toward more electric competition, North Carolina takes it slow. South Carolina House of Representatives just took the first step toward loosening monopoly utilities grip on the state's energy market. Virginia lawmakers are exploring whether to expand competition in the Commonwealth to encourage more renewable energy. In between the two, North Carolina is taking it slow. Despite growing frustrations across the political spectrum with Duke Energy's rising rates and mergers, clean energy plans, there's no clear path to the ending 115-year utilities monopoly outright. Experts caution it will be a huge political and it would guarantee more clean energy and greater consumer power in and of itself in, you have to hold on with me, ladies and gentlemen, as we get back to where we were in our article, because, you know, when you're dealing with these computers, you tap a button, and it'll fly. All right, as we was stating, many say the first step is a comprehensive study to determine how and whether competition would achieve those goals. But even that's imminent. In an election year with a part-time legislature, we need to do something. It's time to look at a change, said Representative John Saki, a Republican from Fayetteville, North Carolina, who chairs the North Carolina House on Energy Committee. But he stressed what we change would have a huge impact. So we need to be deliberate, very deliberate in what we do. They've just been stonewalling. Like many states, North Carolina flirted with deregulation at the start of the century. Then it recalled. In April of 2000, a study commission of legislators and other stakeholders unanimously recommended limited retail and wholesale competition. When the California deregulation crisis blew up, price gouging and speculation on wholesale markets eventually made its way to the retail market. Ratepayers saw rolling blackouts and their bills doubled and even tripled. California imploded, said Richard Hartrett, the founder of the Carolina Solar Energy and member of the study commission. People overnight sourced on this, soured on this whole idea of deregulation. Charlotte-based Duke has since merged with the state's other major electric monopoly, Raleigh-based Progress Energy. Today, the company is one of the nation's largest electric suppliers with a hand in virtually every electron made, distributed, and sold in North Carolina. It produces a vast majority of the state's electricity, most of its coal, gas, and nuclear. It serves about 3.4 million homes and businesses directly, and another 1.6 by selling electricity wholesale to non-profit rural co-ops and municipalities. almost everyone, Duke controls distribution and transmission where it's done, and it still has the footprint in the northeast corner of the state where Virginia-based Dominion Energy delivers electricity and other entity-controlled transmissions. Duke's subsidiary, Piedmont Natural Gas, provides gas services, and it does to about three-fourths of the state counties, with a narrow exception. The third-party electric sales are prohibited. Solar companies can't erect panels and sell the output to anyone other than regulated utilities, and they can't sell their power unless they're connected to the grid, almost exclusive by Duke. Thanks in large part to a favorable state rule under the Federal Public Regulatory Act, plural, independent solar developers gain a sizable foothold here. They own the vast amount of North Carolina's power capacity and the second most in the country. This is very interesting, ladies and gentlemen, okay? Okay, this is very, 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 very interesting, this particular article, because when you begin to read this article, then everything I've been saying about these controlling the generation from generation to transmission to the customer, it states that. And nobody else can get in the game. You're at the mercy if you're trying to build a solar farm in that market niche, a large-scale power plant. You may want to do 20, 30, 50 megawatt farm. You may have the resources. You may have a lot, and you can't do anything because these people got you locked out. You got to come to them and sell the energy to them, and they pay you what they want to give you. And they're not going to give you enough to break ground. And that's how the game is controlled. Now, you will be able to log on to our website and read the entire article under our news and events segment here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And, you know, we are always looking at how we're going to make this thing more interesting, more, how does that impact on my pocketbook? Well, when you are in a market where you cannot put solar on your roof because you cannot get the legislation passed, net metering, because all of those pieces of legislation is what's needed for solar, residential solar, to flourish in the marketplace. And what these large-scale utilities are doing, they're building large-scale solar power plants, but they want to hook you up to a subscription, and they want to own it. They don't want you to become a generator. Well, the sun happened to come up over your roof every day in North Carolina. The sky is a beautiful sky, Carolina sky blue. You know what I'm saying? We have to get